This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
The first hour of the Cincinnati Enquirer on Mondays is brought to you through generous underwriting from the Northeastern Lions Club.
Hello, my name is Mary Capicella. Today is Monday, May 13th, 2024, and I'll be reading from the Cincinnati Enquirer, the business, editorial, and local news. We'll start with the business section. The first article is entitled, LeBron James Approved Blaze Pizza to Open 5 More Restaurants in Greater Cincinnati. You'll soon get more opportunities to eat like a king. Blaze Pizza penned a deal to open 5 more locations in Greater Cincinnati, the company announced in a press release. Basketball star LeBron James is a well-known co-owner and investor in the Fast Fire Da Pizza franchise. A 2022 Mashed article reports James' equity stake in the Pasadena-based company is roughly $40 million as of 2020, and he owns 19 franchise locations. Blaze Pizza offers customers make-your-own fired pizzas that are ready in minutes. There are currently 2 locations in Greater Cincinnati, one in Mason and the other in Cincinnati Northern Kentucky Airport, commonly known as CVG. The 5 new pizzerias will open in Blue Ash, Westchester, Oakley, Northern Kentucky, and Dayton area. The 45-year-old entrepreneur, who already owns the location in Mason, plans to open 1 pizzeria each year for the next 5 years. Patel purchased the Mason pizzeria from the previous owner in February and completely renovated it, he said. This location played a large role in why he decided to become a franchise owner of the pizza company. When he visited the restaurant with his family in 2015, he thought to himself, "Can I ever dream of something like this?" 9 years later, his dream came true. "Something about Blaze is very special," Patel said. He elaborated by saying there are 4 doughs and over 40 toppings to choose from. "People who make a pizza here will never get this pizza anywhere else." Now we move to the opinion section. The first opinion letter is entitled, "Anti-Riot Statute is Constitutional." This was written and is the opinion of Jack Greiner. And it reads, "Shamar Bates recently failed to overturn a federal anti-riot statute on First Amendment grounds. The U.S. Court of Appeals ruled that the statute survived a constitutional challenge. In retrospect, Betts may not have been the ideal challenger. On May 30th, 2020, Betts posted a flyer on Facebook that read, "Riot at Marketplace Mall Time." 3 big friends and family posters, bricks, book bags. Betts posted the flyer during a weekend of George Floyd protest, and it included an image of a burning car flanked by people. Along with the flyer, Betts wrote, "I'm just the messenger. We're literally sitting on our ass watching the whole country and even others fight for our black rights. We gotta put Champaign-Urbana on the map and fear us too." The next day, Betts and a group of 50 to 75 people gathered at Marketplace Mall. At approximately 3:12 p.m., they began damaging property and looting stores. Betts captured the riot on Facebook Live. In another video, Betts is seen looting 2 more stores, Macy's and Old Navy. The riot moved to other businesses on Prospect Avenue and Neal Street. Betts participated in the riot for an hour or so, but rioting apparently lasted until the early morning hours. By the next day, several businesses were damaged and lost merchandise. As revealed in text messages to friends and family, Betts proudly took credit for starting the riot. On appeal, the Seventh Circuit considered the Anti-Riot Act in light of U.S. Supreme Court precedent that has established the requirements for punishing speech that incites violence. Under the precedent, the government might establish that the speech is directed at inciting or producing imminent lawless action, and likely to incite or produce such action. The Anti-Riot Act applies to anyone who transmits a communication, one, to incite a riot, or two, to organize, promote, encourage, participate in, or carry on a riot, and three, to commit any act of violence in furtherance of a riot, or four, to aid or abet any person in inciting or participating in or carrying on a riot or committing any act of violence in furtherance of a riot. Betts argued that the Anti-Riot Act violated the Constitution because it criminalizes acts taken long before a crowd gathers. In other words, Betts' view, the act ignored the imminence required by the Supreme Court precedent. But the Seventh Circuit disagreed. It concluded that the words, quote, organize, promote, encourage, and urging required a close relationship to imminent action. In the Seventh Circuit's view, courts can discern when urging is imminent and when it's not. The harm occasioned by an overly broad statute is that it potentially sweeps protected speech in with unprotected speech. But Betts' case didn't seem particularly close, given his promotion of the riot, his participation in it, and his bragging afterwards. That is the opinion of Jack Greiner, who is a partner at Faruqi PLL Law Firm in Cincinnati. He represents Enquirer Media in the First Amendment and media issues. And the next opinion letter is entitled, Historic No Confidence Vote in Superintendent Should Send a Message to CPS Board. This was written by Glenetta Krause, and it reads, It's hard for taxpayers to wrap our minds around the minutiae of school budgets and contracts, but historic things are happening at Cincinnati Public Schools that our taxpayers should be interested in. The union leaders of all six unions have asked their members to consider a vote of no confidence in our superintendent, Ironetta Wright. To the casual reader, that may sound like a bunch of teachers complaining. It's actually about all our employees wanting to preserve the investment of our community made in our students. It's about making sure that our city's legacy of excellence in education, teaching, and community remains for future generations. I am a Cincinnati resident and taxpayer. I have also taught at CPS since 1993 for great and not as great superintendents. I am a CPS, and I love my work with Cincinnati's young people. For the past 2 years, however, it has been disheartening to work for a superintendent and administrative team who have wasted so much money, time, and goodwill. While everyone will always have some frustrations with their boss, this administration has crossed lines that make it difficult for work to get done. For instance, we're not allowed to send emails to groups that are too large for reasons never clearly explained. We have to wait, sometimes for weeks and months, for the superintendent herself to approve spending or making decisions. Nationwide, hiring teachers is more difficult this year than it has ever been, but our superintendent was so late in getting budgets to our principals that it threw the whole process behind by at least 4 months. This makes it unlikely that we will be able to hire a few of the best and brightest graduates from local colleges, as they've already been snatched up by districts who have their act together. The superintendent says she sought out staff and community input on budget priorities. But the options in those surveys and roundtables didn't mention the things that most union members feel might save our district. Cutting from a bloated administration whose organizational chart has grown from 4 pages to 37 pages in the 2 years of Wright's term. Superintendent Wright hadn't even considered reducing those positions, even after already letting go of some paraprofessionals, nurses, and the super hubs. Wright said she's met with unions and employees, but meeting is not the same as listening, understanding, and collaborating. She's been in meetings and regularly visits our buildings, but according to our internal survey, 75% of her employees still say that she has not, quote, established processes to communicate and collaborate effectively. The board's January 2024 annual evaluation of her performance showed she was significantly below expectations concerning the way she communicates with everyone, including the board, treasurer, staff, and parents. These are just a few of the reasons that unions representing not only teachers, but secretaries, custodians, electricians, food service workers, carpenters, principals, interpreters, security officers, and planned operators have decided that Superintendent Wright has lost the confidence and trust of her employees. To my knowledge, 3 of the 6 unions have voted and agreed, and 3 have yet to vote. I hope these votes also send a message to you, my fellow Cincinnati taxpayers. We are the board's employers. If you're as inspired as I have been by this historic display of solidarity, this demand that our schools run by the rules, please let the school board know. Make sure the board knows that you value our schools and will not allow one person to diminish them or the people who work in them. Make the board know that we've already lost valuable workers and precious time that we'll never get back because of the untenable situation Ironetta Wright and her team puts us in. Again, that was written by Glenetta Krause, who lives in Clifton. And the next opinion letter is entitled, "Time to Stop Blaming CPS Superintendents and Other Opinions You Read Most of the Week." Written by Kevin S. Aldrich. And it reads, "Cincinnati Public School Superintendent Ironetta Wright recently celebrated her 2-year anniversary with the nearly 36,000 school student district. Her anniversary gift? The district's unions are rallying against her, meeting for votes of no confidence, and claiming Wright's leadership style is controlling and inefficient. If the unions get their way, Wright won't see a 3rd anniversary. But that decision ultimately lies in the hands of the CPS school board. The rift between the superintendent and district personnel has sparked vigorous debate in the community about how we got here and, more importantly, where do we go next. It also generated 2 of our most read opinions this week, one in the support of Wright and 1 criticizing her leadership. Former Cincinnati councilman and Hamilton County treasurer Charlie Winburn of Mount Airy came to Wright's defense in an op-ed calling for school board members to take accountability for the district's low performance over the years. Winburn said blaming every superintendent for the lack of student achievement lets the board, teachers, and staff off the hook. Winburn wrote, quote, "It's time to stop the blame again. to cease hiding behind the failures of past superintendents and to confront hard truth that the responsibility lies with each and every member of the Cincinnati Public School Board of Education. Krause described Wright as a poor communicator who meets with unions and employees, but, quote, meeting is not the same as listening, understanding, and collaborating. Tell me what you think the Public School Board of Education should do about this situation by dropping me a letter or op-ed. Should the district move on from Wright after just 2 years? Or do you think she deserves more time to realize her vision and plan for the district? Do you think things are getting better or worse at CPS in terms of student performance? What do you think is the best way to resolve the matter of the best interest of CPS students? Again, that is the opinion of Kevin S. Aldridge, who is the opinion and engagement editor for the Enquirer. Now we move to the local news. The first article is entitled, Suspect in Shooting Death of Euclid, Ohio, Police Officer Dead After Standoff. The man suspected in the shooting of a Euclid police officer died in Shaker Heights after a standoff with SWAT that started Sunday afternoon. Deshaun Anthony Vaughn, 24, is suspected of shooting Euclid police officer Jacob Durbin, 23, after police were called to a residence on the 300 block of East 211th Street just before 10 p.m. Saturday for a disturbance, according to News 5 Cleveland. This is my worst nightmare come true, says Euclid Police Chief Scott Mayer during a press conference Sunday evening. He added that Durbin's father also is a Euclid police officer and that the younger Durbin was engaged. The chief said, quote, his kind heart and his enormous smile were infectious. He will be desperately missed by all those who knew him. Multiple police agencies closed down the area of Lee Road and Van Aken Boulevard due to SWAT activity starting at around 1:45 on Sunday, according to the Akron Beacon Journal. U.S. Marshal Pete Elliott said during the press conference that the suspect was believed to be heavily armed and, quote, had a very violent, violent history. Law enforcement was able to evacuate the people at the apartment complex where Vaughn had been found, and no other injuries were reported from the standoff. Meyer said that the officers had been called after a woman called saying that the father of her child, Vaughn, was threatening to harm them. Meyer said that she was extremely terrified. When officers responded, Vaughn opened fire on them and shot Durbin. No other officers were injured. Euclid officers returned fire, but Vaughn ran away. Meyer said authorities were still piecing together the series of events in the standoff and that more information would be released in the future as more is known. Shaker Heights Police Chief Wayne Hudson said the crime scene was secure and the case was still being investigated. Hudson said, quote, to kill a law enforcement officer is to tear the fabric of democracy. And the next article is entitled, More Ohioans Could Be Committed to a Hospital Against Their Will Under Proposed Law. Ohio lawmakers may expand the criteria for committing people to a hospital against their will. House Bill 249 would allow officers to hospitalize people if they refuse treatment or fail to take their medication, for example, have been diagnosed with one of five mental health conditions and are expected to suffer mental deterioration if not treated. The conditions outlined in the bill are schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, delusional disorder, and major depressive disorder. Supporters say the change is necessary so police officers can intervene before someone is in crisis. Opponents are concerned that increased hospitalizations would mean a loss of liberty for people with disabilities and could do more harm than good. When a person is hospitalized against their will, currently someone can be involuntarily committed if they would be a substantial risk of physical harm to themselves or others and meet one of five criteria: threats or attempts of suicide, recent homicidal or violent behavior, immediate risk of a person injuring themselves. The person would benefit from treatment, and there is evidence of behavior that seriously and immediately puts themselves or others at risk. And the person would benefit from treatment and is unlikely to survive safely in the community and has a history of not complying with treatment. Ralph Stover Jr., a patrol sergeant for the Talmadge Police Department near Akron, said the expansion is necessary for officers who realize someone is not doing well, but they are not yet endangering themselves or others to the point that they can be hospitalized involuntarily. Advocates say forced hospitalization can make things worse. Kirsten Joburg, executive director of Disability Rights Ohio, said the phase psychiatric deterioration is too broad and it may not be in line with constitutional standard. She said she would like to see a focus on community resources and a holistic approach to treating mental illness, as well as alternative forms of crisis response, such as having social workers accompany police officers on mental health calls to talk to the person about what's going on and help them feel safer in their environment. We really need to be cautious about the places that are providing that care, she said. So I think the idea that they might become over capacity or understaffed because of the increasing number of people that are being forced into hospitalization is certainly one thing to think about. Stover said by intervening earlier, treatment and evaluation will be simpler and takes less time than if someone is in crisis and needs more time in a bed to stabilize. The next article is entitled, One Dead, Two Injured After Being Shot Inside Car, Middletown Police Say. One person is dead and two people are in the hospital after they were shot in a car in Middletown early Sunday. In a news release, Middletown police said first responders were sent at 3:25 a.m. to the 1700 block of Sheffield Street for a report of gunshots. When they arrived at the scene, they found that three people had been shot while sitting in a car, police said. Two of the three were taken to Atrium Medical Center for treatment. The third was pronounced dead on the scene. None of the victims' identities have been released, and no suspect information was available. The next article is entitled, Syphilis Up 80% in Hamilton County, Highlighting Treatment Barriers Across Ohio. Syphilis cases reached a six-year high in Hamilton County in 2023, according to an April report from the Public Health Department. At 582 cases, the total represents an 80% increase since 2018, mirroring a national trend that prompted the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to declare a national epidemic of syphilis in January. Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Columbus all saw syphilis rates higher than the statewide average for each year between 2018 and 2022, according to the data from the Ohio Department of Health. Mike Semmett, spokesperson for the Hamilton County Department of Public Health, said, quote, "There is no definitive answer as to why syphilis diagnoses are increasing. The doctors that the Enquirer contacted for this story agreed and cited the lack of easily accessible sexually transmitted infection tests as one reason why the epidemic has been difficult to treat. And the next article is entitled, Women of the Year Nominations Are Open. Here are today's top stories. I think of that quote from Margaret Thatcher when I read about the amazing accomplishments of the women who have been named Enquirer Women of the Year. Hi, I'm Enquirer editor Burl Love. The more than 500 women honored since the program debuted in 1968 come from all walks of life, and they share a common trait. They've made our community a better place through their hard work, perseverance, and selfless philanthropy. Nominations are now open for this year's awards. If you would like to nominate someone who has made meaningful contributions to the greater good through her profession or volunteer efforts, click on the link and tell us why they should be part of this year's class. Mark your calendars. The annual Enquirer Women of the Year luncheon will be held October 24th at the Hard Rock Cafe. And that link would be www.cincinnatienquirer.com. And the next article is entitled, First Person to Receive Pig Kidney Dies 7 Weeks After Transplant. Richard Slayman, the first person to ever receive a kidney from a pig, has died, according to Massachusetts General Hospital, where the transplant was performed in March. In a statement late Saturday, the transplant team said they, quote, have no indication Slayman's death was the result of the transplant, which the hospital had heralded as the major scientific achievement. Slayman, 62, a systems manager for the Massachusetts Department of Transportation, had already endured a transplant with a human kidney that had to be removed because of complications and was struggling with 3 times a week dialysis when he agreed to the experimental pig kidney procedure. When they announced that surgery had been successful, the Mass General team said such animal-to-human transplants, known as xenotransplantation, offer the possibility of solving the human organ shortage and a potential option for the hundreds of thousands of Americans suffering on dialysis. The hospital's Saturday statement included comments from family members, saying they were, quote, deeply saddened by his passing, but grateful for the extra 7 weeks they had with Slayman. Mass General Transplant team members, some of whom had treated Slayman for years, praised his generosity and kindness and described him as, quote, a hope, a beacon of hope for other patients. We are deeply grateful for his trust and willingness to advance the field of xenotransplantation, the team said. The woman, the woman who received a pig kidney at NYU Langone Health on April 4th continues to recover. Her heart and kidney are functioning optimally, Dr. Robert Montgomery said, who directs the NYU Langone Transplant Institute. Montgomery said, quote, while she remains under intensive care, we see progress after her long history of health challenges. The pig organs used for transplant come from animals that are gene edited to make their organs less likely to be rejected by the human immune system. Rejection, which is common among human-to-human transplants, likely caused the death of one of the heart transplant patients who died 6 weeks after surgery. No rejection was evident in the other two. And the next article is entitled, Cincinnati May Be Treated to Widespread Display of Northern Lights. This was written on May 12th at 11:30 a.m. The Northern Lights may grace the Cincinnati region again on Sunday. Overnight, Friday and Saturday, Ohioans had a rare chance to see the Aurora Borealis right from their doorsteps due to a strong solar storm, which brought views of the celestial pink and green Northern Lights to many portions of the U.S. Sunday night skies yield the same and even more intense results. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Space Weather Prediction Center forecast a geomagnetic storm at a G4 level out of 5 possible early Sunday night through Sunday night. The next series of very fast-moving corona mass ejections will slam into the Earth's magnetic field and is expected to lead back to severe to extreme geomagnetic storms. This means that aurora will be widespread and can be seen at lower latitudes, including here in Ohio. Favorable conditions in Sunday night's forecast means we may have another chance to experience the Northern Lights. And the next article is entitled, Pedestrian Dies After Being Hit by Car in Goshen Township. A woman is dead after she was hit by a car in Goshen Township early Sunday. Jacqueline Rogers, 41, of Loveland, was walking on Ohio 28 when she was hit, according to a news release from the Ohio State Highway Patrol. At 1:53 a.m., a Chevrolet Malibu was traveling eastbound when it struck Rogers, who was walking in the roadway at milepost 10, the release stated. Rogers was taken to Bethesda North Hospital, where she was pronounced dead. The driver of the Malibu was wearing a seatbelt and was not injured. The Highway Patrol continues investigating the crash. And the next article is entitled, Man Faces Murder Charge in Death of 21-month-old in Westwood. A man has been charged with murder in the death of a 21-month-old found unresponsive in Westwood last week, police said. Police and fire personnel were called to Erlene Drive on the morning of May 3rd, investigators said, and found Kareem Keita. The Cincinnati Fire Department started life-saving measures and transported the child to Children's Hospital Medical Center, where he later succumbed to his injuries, Cincinnati police said in a release. The following day, Edward Murray, 23, was arrested and charged with murder. Police have not said why Kareem died or what relationship Murray had with the baby. Court documents related to the case were not available at the time of this report. And the next article is entitled, Pro-Palestine Protesters Who Were Arrested at Xavier University to Be Arraigned on Monday. The two pro-Palestine protesters who were arrested outside of a Xavier University graduation ceremony on Saturday are scheduled for an arraignment Monday. The protesters are a current student and recent graduate, the university said. Court records show Julia Lankish, 22, and Sophia Dempsey, 22, were arrested Saturday at Xavier and were released on their own recognizance on the same day. The protests occurred in front of the CINTAS Center, where Xavier University's undergraduate commencement ceremony was to begin that morning, the university said in a statement. Dempsey said Lankish and Lankish are charged with criminal trespassing, which is considered a misdemeanor, and violating the prohibition against conspiracy while wearing disguise statute. The latter makes it a felony to commit a crime, even a misdemeanor, with two or more other people while wearing masks. This was emphasized in a letter Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost wrote to Ohio University presidents in response to the recent pro-Palestinian protest. According to the letter, violating this law is punishable by 6 to 18 months in prison. Dempsey and Lankish will be arraigned 9 a.m. on Monday in Hamilton County Municipal Court. A small group of protesters were also present prior to the beginning of commencement at Hussman Stage, the university said. According to its X account, XU Free Palestine is a group of Xavier University students unaffiliated from the university, and that is, quote, demanding a divestment from Israel. According to the university's statement, the arrest occurred after the individuals ignored a request by Xavier University to relocate to Hussman Stage, Xavier University's designated demonstration area. As a result, the protesters were arrested without incident at roughly 7:30 a.m. The university said in a statement, quote, while nonviolent campus demonstrations by Xavier students, faculty, and staff are welcome, university policy states it may limit the time, place, and manner of demonstrations to ensure disruptions to campus operations. As an institution, we wholeheartedly encourage the exchange of diverse ideas and viewpoints as central to the development of the whole person. Further, we are steadfast in creating an environment of Ignatian belonging where all are encouraged to engage in peaceful assembly for the exchange of ideas, the statement read. As is the case every spring, the university carefully prepared for commencement day with the chief goal of maintaining campus safety while creating an opportunity for our students and their families to celebrate this milestone achievement. The organization also made demands, including that the university divest from Israel and end all academic trips to Israel, for Police Chief Robert Warfall to resign or be fired, and for the university faculty committee to hold a vote of no confidence in President Colleen Henses. The Enquirer was submitted a public records request for the incident report. The Cincinnati-based private Jesuit university is now the latest Ohio university to have been the site of a student-organized protest in support of Palestine. Other universities include Ohio State University and Miami University in Oxford. And the next article is entitled, FDA's Vape Regulation Failures Jeopardize Public Health. As campaign season continues to heat up, both parties are fighting to differentiate themselves in the eyes of the American voter. Yet, despite deep political division, recent controversy in the area of public health showed that both parties agree on one thing. The FDA Center for Tobacco Products is failing the American people and jeopardizing American lives. On April 11th, the House Committee on Oversight and Accountability held a hearing, Oversight of the Food and Drug Administration, to question FDA Commissioner Robert Califf on the agency's activity across a range of areas. The most heated discussion centered around the FDA's failure to effectively regulate the exploding market for illegal vapes. Millions of illegal, disposable, and flavored vapes manufactured in China are being illegally smuggled into the United States. Sold in every community, they have become the top choice for middle and high schoolers. These products are manufactured without any supervision or oversight, using unknown materials and ingredients. Republicans and Democrats pounced on the FDA's failure to protect children from illegal Chinese vapes. Representative James Comer, Republican from Kentucky, chairman of the House Oversight Committee, denounced Califf's lack of action, stating that American retail shelves are inundated with goods from China, and yet the FDA doesn't appear to be taking any action on this issue. According to the scientific research from a broad range of public health authorities, innovation over the past decade has created technology that allows for nicotine consumption with as much as 95% less harm than smoking cigarettes. Nicotine itself is not what causes cancer, and most diseases come from other chemicals in cigarette smoke. Vapes can provide nicotine without burning tobacco and inhaling smoke, thereby substantially reducing risk. Former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb stated that transitioning every adult smoker to e-cigarettes could significantly benefit public health. The FDA, which regulates tobacco products, created a process to assess products and approve those that are appropriate for the protection of public health. To date, the FDA has received over 26 million applications from vape manufacturers, but has only approved 23 products for sale, effectively banning the rest or creating confusion around their legality. Strict prohibition of a popular adult product without any real enforcement capability has created a vast criminal market that has overwhelmed the government, flooding communities from coast to coast with illegal vapes from China. Right now, America is facing a health crisis as misinformation around nicotine and the government's failure to effectively regulate the market are creating a perfect storm. And the next article is entitled, Red Bikes Back on Greater Cincinnati Streets Starting Monday. Cincinnati's bike share program restarts Monday after cobbling together a bailout plan in recent weeks. Red Bike Executive Director Doug McClintock, Cincinnati City Council member Mark Jeffries, and other dignitaries will be on hand 9:30 a.m. to relaunch in front of Cincinnati City Hall, according to a release. The 10-year-old service paused in January to address budget pressures. On the brink of shutting down in March, Jeffries took a lead role in raising more than $500,000 to operate Red Bank for at least another year. And the next article is entitled, Hand and Stone Massage and Facial Spa opens Kenwood location, its largest in Ohio. Treating yourself to a massage might become easier. Hand and Stone Massage and Facial Spa opened a new location in Kenwood on May 3rd, according to a news release. The Kenwood location is the luxury spa franchise's largest location in Ohio. The brand has 8 spas in the greater Cincinnati area and a total of 21 in the state, the release said. The company plans to expand the franchise to 30 locations in Ohio in the coming years. Mike Masco, regional developer for the Kenwood Hand and Stone Spa, said in a release, quote, "Our mission goes beyond providing exceptional spa experiences. It's about empowering individuals to prioritize self-care and well-being. Our Ohio-based development team is committed to elevating the standard of health and relaxation in the region, and the opening of our new Kenwood Spa will provide even more accessible wellness services to the Cincinnati area. For new customers, the spa offers introductory prices for a massage or facial around $80. The Kenwood location is currently offering promotional rates through the upcoming week. You can receive $20 off introductory prices through Sunday with the promotional code OHIO20. The spa told the Enquirer in an email. The spa is located at 8154 Montgomery Road. And the next article is entitled, Coroner IDs 75-year-old woman killed in Central Parkway crash. A 75-year-old woman died in a crash on Central Parkway on Tuesday. The Hamilton County Coroner's Office identified the woman on Wednesday morning as Doris Ruff. Cincinnati police said the crash happened at 3:14 p.m. Police said Ruff was operating a 2012 Chevrolet Cruze eastbound on West Liberty Street at Central Parkway, disregarded a red light, and collided with two vehicles at the intersection, resulting in minor damage. The driver turned south on Central Parkway, traveling south in the northbound lanes. As the vehicle approached West 12th Street, it traveled off the left side of the roadway, striking a curb and sideswiping a building. The vehicle was disabled due to damage sustained in the second crash and came to a stop at 1100 Central Parkway. The Cincinnati Fire Department took Ruff to the University of Cincinnati Medical Center, where she later died. Excessive speed and impairment are not believed to be factors in the crash. Ruff was not wearing a seatbelt. Any witnesses to this crash are asked to contact the Cincinnati Police Department's traffic unit. And the next article is entitled, Bourbon Industry Brings Significant Economic Impact to Kentucky. Kentucky's bourbon industry is rich in tradition, but also means a bright future in the Commonwealth. As a signature industry in the state, Kentucky's bourbon and spirits sector is responsible for over 23,000 jobs, with an annual payroll topping $2.16 billion. The key sector also generates $9 billion in economic impact, providing a significant boost to the state's soaring economy. Since the beginning of Governor Andy Beshear's administration, Kentucky's bourbon and spirits industry has announced 102 new location and expansion projects, totaling $4.2 billion in investment and creating over 1,800 jobs. At no point was this impact felt more than in 2022, when Kentucky recorded its single best year for growth of its signature industry, with the private sector new location and expansion projects totaling over $2.1 billion in investments and approximately 700 new jobs for Kentucky residents. This record-setting year was highlighted by Louisville-based Sazerac Company, which in November of 2022 announced the largest distilled spirits-related investment on record in Kentucky history, with a $600 million investment in London. The project is creating up to 50 full-time jobs and supporting the company's continued growth. In July of that year, Beam Suntory announced the expansion of its Jim Beam Brands company with a $400 million investment that will create more than 50 full-time jobs at the Booker No Distillery in Boston. Governor Beshear says, quote, "The growth of Kentucky's bourbon industry is one of the most important factors in our state's recent economic success. We've made tremendous strides in not only growing the number of distilleries in the Commonwealth, but increasing the supporting infrastructure of the industry, adding rickhouses, storage warehouses, bottling centers, and manufacturing facilities all over the state. Combined with the emphasis on tourism, our bourbon and spirits sector is creating job opportunities and driving economic momentum in every corner of Kentucky. The success that has continued, highlighted by major announcements from both Legacy Spirits of Kentucky, LLC, and Staghorn. Legacy Spirits announced a more than $250 million investment in a new bourbon distillery and restaurant in Madison County, creating 80 new Kentucky jobs. Meanwhile, Staghorn announced a new distillery in Garrett County, another $250 million project, creating 60 quality jobs. Those are just a few of the recent significant announcements helping move the industry forward in Kentucky. Kentucky's continued bourbon boom has played a critical role in the state's record surging economy and shows no signs of slowing down. At the end of 2023, there are 100 licensed distilleries operated by 84 companies in 42 Kentucky counties, five times the number of distilleries since 2009. With a 135% growth in employment and a 160% growth in wages. Distilleries across the state are setting new marks for production. Distillers produced a record 2.7 million barrels of bourbon in 2022. The continued growth and expansion of distilleries, barrel storage warehouses, and bottling and distribution centers continued to play a major role in the Commonwealth's continued economic success. The momentum of one of Commonwealth's signature industries is fueling growth in communities across the state, from startups to distilleries rich in history. There's no question that bourbon is booming in Kentucky. And the last article in the news is entitled, Just Askin', Who's Behind the Painted Doors, Windows on Cincinnati's Boarded Up Buildings? Walking through downtown Cincinnati, you might have noticed some old abandoned buildings now have windows and doors, or at least it looks that way. Wooden boards on vacant buildings around town have been given facelifts. Artists transform the wooden boards that cover windows and doors into create a brand new artificial facade. Is it a group of vigilante painters, or is it a part of a coordinated effort? A local nonprofit aimed at primping the Queen City is behind these murals. Since 2009, Keep Cincinnati Beautiful has been working to eradicate eyesore vacant buildings through its Future Blooms program. The goal is to uplift communities by showing the potential in a property that may have been boarded up for a long time. More than 1,500 buildings have been painted since the program started, says Katie Davis, Keep Cincinnati Beautiful Arts Program co-director. A group of artists paints the wooden boards into highly realistic representations of windows and boards. Many of the buildings are in downtown and over the Rhine, but the Future Blooms has extended its work into more than a dozen neighborhoods. The hope is someone may take interest in a building due to its cosmetic changes or reduce blight and can increase economic development. Keep Cincinnati Beautiful says the project has created a 17% reduction in blight, a 15% reduction in crime, and a 48% increase in economic development in the surrounding area where they provide public artworks. And that covers today's readings, May 13th, of the Cincinnati Enquirer. This is a reading from the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. My name is Mary Capicella. Have a great day and a safe week.